So I can talk about like definitely what's happening today in Syria. I cannot be like talking about without talking about the uprisings, the other uprisings that happened in the region. So after the uprising in Tunisia and the revolution in Tunisia, and after the revolution in Egypt, we are seeing the Syrian people uprising also, asking for more freedom and to end this systematic system of oppression and authoritarian regime in Syria too. And like, and this is exactly like the link is, if we look at the how it started by like a few kids, 9 to 13 years old kids. They were inspired by what happened in the region, and like they went and wrote on the wall the most famous slogan in these countries, that Ash-Shaab Yurid Iskat Al-Nidham, which means the people wants the fall of the regime. So they wrote it, they made a graffiti on the wall, and these 9 to 13 years old kids were arrested by the security, Syrian security forces. They were detained, they were tortured, and when their parents asked about them, the security forces said, forget about your kids. And then like that's how like that's the first like incident that happened. And then like the parents decided, and they are from Daraa, which is the city where most of the repression is happening today, but it spread after that to many other places. But this is when the people started demonstrating, first to get these kids released, but also to it grew up to become actually an uprising. And it spread from one city to the other, from the east to the west, to the north, to the south. And we can talk more about what's happening today. It started, the first demonstration was in March 18.
You asked about the context of Syria and the situation of Syria before the uprising. I just like to add that I think we could honestly say that the Syrian situation was one of the worst in the region in terms of repression and in terms of the crackdown on civil liberties and freedoms in the country. Syria has a very long history of human rights violation in terms of also torture and detention, arbitrary detention. We've had the longest emergency state in the region. For 49 years, there was an emergency state. That means that all rights are suspended de facto. The security forces can arrest anyone anytime for the last 49 years without any accusations, without a warrant, without anything. They could just take them. They disappear for months, for years, never come back. These are stories that are daily stories in Syrian families. The latest, once the uprising started, we heard about the lifting of the emergency laws, well, the emergency state. The day after that, we've had the biggest massacre in Daraa, in other regions also in the country, in Izra specifically, where we've seen horrific images of kids being shot at the head and the chest, showing that there was an intent actually of killing, and these people were actually targeted. And all the footage shows people were unarmed protesters with kids and unarmed people that unbuttoned their shirts in some cases to show that we have nothing to hide. We are peaceful. We are there to demand. I think the uprising in Syria erupted at a point which could not be delayed further. And I think that the detention of these kids that Rami mentioned and their torture was, I think, the straw for the Syrian people. We've seen targeted violence against kids. UNICEF has talked about it and has denounced it as well.
I think when we look at situations such as the one we're seeing in Syria now, and trying to understand how what led to them arising in the way that they have, I guess we're always interested in looking at causes and of two types, as Rami was mentioning, the most immediate or causes, and I think Rami gave a good account of those, and Bushra mentioned something of the deeper, longer term causes. And I'll just add to what Bushra said that there has been, and there's a context and a set of conditions that have emerged in Syria that, in a way, explain why Syrians felt the need to do something as drastic as they have to change their conditions. In addition to the repression, the state repression that has been going on for decades, we have also, I think, a set of economic conditions in which people were seeing their generally economic conditions declining in Syria, unemployment rates rising, no hope in a way of getting out of unemployment, or being faced with continuous poor employment, an informal economic life based on informal trade and informal work and so on and so forth, also beginning to burgeon, pockets of poverty. So there's a set of also very pronounced economic conditions that you see in other parts of the Middle East, and that gave rise to those revolutions as well. And I'll just finally mention as well that over the last 10 years, especially, a shift in economic management and economic policy towards what we've come to understand as neoliberal forms of economic management that would make some people very wealthy, but most other people are just excluded and marginalized from opportunity, from wealth, from meeting their daily economic needs.
I was wondering if we could speak about the significance of Hamza Khatib and his story and the history a bit about why today is being called the Friday of the Children of Freedom.
I think there are two incidents that have shocked the world and the Syrian people equally. This is not to say that the Syrian regime was not capable of doing such horrors, except that this time it was exposed to the whole world. The story of Hamza al-Khatib is a very specific story, and people have actually said, I've heard people say that the Syrian revolution is something else after Hamza al-Khatib. It has touched them so personally, because this kid of 13 years old was detained in one of the protests in end of April, if I'm not mistaken, and returned on May 21st to his family as a body, mutilated, tortured, emasculated, to add to the provocation also, I think, to the family, with signs of severe torture, cigarette burns on his body. His family was asked to sign a waiver that they will not show his body or denounce it. But I think once they saw the body, they could not stand it. So a short footage, a video was filmed and was diffused over the internet, Facebook, all social networks, and has shocked the world. This kid shows the horrific violence to which they're capable of. And it has made people feel so strongly about it. And there was the other incident that I also wanted to mention was also the targeting of a bus filled with kids that was targeted and shot at, and people were injured, some were killed. So there has been violence targeted at children in the last weeks, and this has been the reason why the Friday today was called the Friday for the Children of Freedom, because people wanted to speak out about it.
Children are participating in these in the protests, in the communities, in the cities, in the towns throughout Syria. It seems that the forces, the government forces that are cracking down, that are using repression and violence to prevent people from protesting in peaceful ways and expressing their legitimate demands, are in some ways, they're targeting people irrespective of who they are. And I think, and it's really, I think, part of a modus operandi of the Syrian state. It's just finding its extreme expressions now, given the conditions and the challenge that's facing the state, and that is that it's a modus operandi taken to its ultimate extreme, and that is, you know, killing of innocents, seemingly without without limit, and also brutalization of people when they're in custody. In a way, it's a, I think, possibly intended to increase and deepen the fear that the state is deployed, that is part of the state strategy to govern. I think in some ways it's a conscious way of governing through fear, but I think in other ways it's just an indication that the modus operandi can reach these kind of extreme expressions.
Just one thing also I want to mention, like the demonstrations in Syria, demonstrators in Syria have been trying hard to like keep this protest peaceful, because they know that if it turns into like violence, the security forces have more force to actually take over, or it might turn into a civil war. So like I think these kinds of provocations of killing kids and like shooting at civilians, it's kind of like provocation by the regime to actually push people to maybe turn into violent or to do something that will actually turn against them. What's amazing by the Syrian people is that actually with all these things, they're still saying, no, we're peaceful. And we're going to die, but we're not going to turn this into, first of all, a civil war or give any excuse for any like international forces to intervene, like in Libya or anything. This is a very amazing position by the Syrian people. And I hope they can continue being peaceful with all these horrible things that are happening to them.
We have to remember, this is a police state. It's the only way to think or act is in terms of security, in terms of repression. So the targeting of these kids is actually to increase the fear that has been broken finally after 49 years in Syria. So they don't know how to deal with this. So they're trying all sorts of things. This is the thug mentality. They're cornered. They feel that they need to do something extreme to bring back that fear, because people have lost the fear. They're ready to die. One of the famous slogans that has been chanted in protest is al-maut wal-al-madhalla, meaning death but not humiliation, because this is what has been happening for the last years. So people are ready to die. But this is not enough. So let's take the kids and torture them and send them back to their families, because a lot of bodies were not sent back to their families. Why did they send that kid's body to his family? Emasculated. You have to put yourself also in the mentality of southern Syria. Tribal, a lot of pride, a lot of honor. This is a direct insult to the whole region. And to provoke them also, I think, to take up arms. But as Rami said, this is it's so inspiring, and their courage is just beyond imagination, and their commitment to nonviolence and peaceful means is really commendable.
بالبخور مطارح يحن بها كل قلب أكبر فما أفعل كي أنا على رضاك وفيك بذرت صبايا وأبشر فهل من يزغرد ويعلي نداء لفرحة قلب بجرح تخمر فما أفعل كي أنا على رضاك وفيك بذرت صبايا وأبشر شآم أنت فتاتي وأمي حضنت صبايا فهل فيك أكبر ووعد دهري فعليت قبري وفستان عرسي بفلك أعمر
We were listening to the song Sham by Lina Shamimya, an Armenian-Syrian singer. The first question is directed a little bit more towards Brian regarding the effects of the Syrian revolution and the protests on migration between Canada and Syria. How will the Syrian diaspora in Montreal or in other parts of Canada be affected by what's going on in Syria right now?
Well, it's hard to say much about the effects of Syrian migration into Canada as a result of this. I mean, what we know is that there have been refugee movements from Syria into neighboring states and especially into Lebanon. Whether or not that's going to have further effects insofar as Canada is concerned, it's possible. But I mean, you know, events such as this, developments such as this always have migration effects, whether they're internal or regional, and then inevitably they have some effects beyond the borders of the state where people are displaced or beyond the region. But I think more interestingly maybe is to think about how the people, you know, migrants from Syria living in Canada and other migrant communities are responding to what's happening in Syria. I think what we've seen in Syria, as we have with respect to communities, Egyptian communities and Tunisian and other and elsewhere since the end of 2010 and throughout 2011 up until now, has been this kind of unprecedented level of mobilization on the part of migrant communities who've at some stage in their history have migrated to this country, whether only in the last 50 years or in the case of Syrians for more than 100 years. So I think people are more intensely observing, engaging, following what's happening in their places of origin and also becoming politically engaged. And in diaspora communities, inevitably, that engagement always turns towards the state of which they are now citizens. And so for Canada, people are looking at what the Canadian government is doing, trying to influence the stands that it's taken. Most recently, Canada has imposed sanctions on Syria, specific set of sanctions. I won't go into the details because there's not a lot of time. But I think something to be borne in mind about those sanctions is that, I mean, for many of us, they arise as kind of disingenuous, if not hypocritical, one would say, given Canada's policies and especially the Conservative government's policies with respect to the region. And that is its uncompromising and unqualified support for the State of Israel. So these gestures on the part of the Canadian government, and that would be my personal opinion, I think it's shared by a number of other people, seem to be somewhat inconsistent insofar as Israel seems to be excused from all of its violations, whereas Canada, and I mean, it's not to say that we don't think that these are steps in the right direction. It's something that the collective has called for. So that's one form, I think, that makes one a bit less than willing to congratulate the Canadian government. The other thing is Canada's known complicity in torture of Canadian citizens of Syrian origin in Syria in the 2000s as part of its participation in the war on terror.
My next question is just speaking to activism in Syria itself, and how is information traveling amongst activists?
I'm actually very glad you asked that question, because there has been a systematic blockade on information by the Syrian authorities. All journalists are banned from Syria. International journalists are banned from Syria. No independent observers can go inside the country and report on what's happening. So all we hear is not confirmed, allegedly, even though some information we know from people inside that are happening for sure. But because there is a ban on international media to go in and report, there has been a complete isolation. So the only means that people have is their own cell phones, Facebook, Twitter, when there's internet and electricity, because in some cases we know in Daraa there was a complete cut of electricity and water and for days and days and days, and internet obviously in a lot of areas as well. They use their cell phone providers sometimes to send information. So it's very, very, very difficult also for human rights groups to get all the information right away. But this is the only ways the information is getting out. And that's why our demonstration on June 11th has the picture of a cell phone, because this has been the only weapon that Syrians have been using to actually expose the Syrian regime.
When did the Collective for Syria form, and what are you working on right now?
It was like a spontaneous foundation, let's say. Like, people just met and felt they need to do something here. So just after the first incidences in Syria, the collective start meeting, and we have organized a few vigils and protests. And on June 11, there's a global day of action for Syria. It includes Montreal, but other cities in the world as well. So it's June 11, and we ask all the people in Montreal to come and join us, because it's very important to stand in solidarity with these people that are being killed and tortured, and against all this injustice. So it's June 11 at 1 on the corner of Guy and Maisonneuve.